So welcome to this podcast for the next in the series of Leadership Takeaways. And here with me today is, I'm very pleased to announce, is Eric Newton. Hi, Eric.
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I said, pleased to announce. God, that sounded a bit formal, didn't it? I'm really great to have you. You're all the way from San Francisco, and you run a business called Together.Guide, and you are the founder of that relationship guide business, but very much based on you being a podcaster and talking to clients through that way. And we met on Twitter, as I was explaining, on our Google Hangout. We've just done a video and now we're doing the podcast. And so all mediums that we're getting out there, which is wonderful. And this is just the follow-up, but to look at why you've been successful at what you do, Eric. So I'm just going to delve into the sections unless there's anything you'd like to say about San Francisco and what's going on today with you in San Francisco.
Well, it's been raining like cats and dogs, and today is our first sunny day, so I'm excited to get out there and have some sunshine.
Oh wow, and one day I will come and visit San Francisco because it just looks beautiful from the pictures. So
it's extraordinary. Yeah, if you've never been here, you've got to visit at least once.
I will. And I do adore this, being able to do podcasts and hangouts and speak to, my last couple of interviews have been with American people. The last guy was from San Diego. So it's a joy to actually be able to, there's no limitations now with what we can do. So thank you ever so much for joining me. So
yeah,
what I will do, Eric, is I'll get into the first section of Leadership Takeaways, where we look at strategy.
Okay.
So sort of kick it off, I would say to you, when you set about, previously we talked in our Google Hangout about you being an ex-family lawyer. When you started out in life, what was your strategy for life, for career, for jobs? Where were you headed? How did you know which way you were headed with your strategy?
Well, how far back? I think there've been some different... I've had different approaches, for better or worse, throughout the process. For instance, when I started law school, my strategy was just to have fun. And I was pretty much entirely certain I would never be a lawyer, and that the whole reason to go to law school was adventure. And
wow.
Then, of course, I ended up being a lawyer. So that didn't work out as I planned, but I think law school was...
So you went to law school because you thought it'd be adventurous, but you knew that it wouldn't be fun. Is that what you're saying?
I had always had this fantasy that after becoming a billionaire entrepreneur, I would go back to law school just for the sake of the education. Mm. And who knows if these kinds of fantasies are realistic. I suppose for some percentage of the population, they're realistic. And for the rest of us, it's not. And then we each think that we were right. But regardless of that kind of hindsight, I always respected the education component of law school and thought of it as a kind of a boot camp for the mind. And so... what was actually going on at that time, I was running nightclubs and 9/11 happened, and the nightclub business in DC where I was living was destroyed because nobody wanted to go out after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, nightclubs aren't working out. What if I went to law school now? It seemed a little early. I certainly wasn't a billionaire yet, but I thought I'd just give it a shot and applied and got in and really thought of it like, as I said, I thought of it like an adventurous boot camp, like a way to test my mettle, to see if I could succeed in that extreme environment. And that's how I treated it for the first year. I went in like I was going into the military, and as a result, I didn't traumatize myself too much like a lot of people do going into law school. I knew it was going to be difficult, and I went into it because it was going to be difficult. And I think I got a lot of value as a result of that approach. In some sense, I never took it too seriously.
Yeah.
And then when I did start to take it seriously, and I guess taking it seriously means two different things. On one hand, I took it seriously because I knew it would be difficult. But on the other hand, I didn't really think it mattered if I became a lawyer or if I got the right job, you know, or if I was respected by my legal colleagues. But I did, I think, inevitably catch that bug. And when I did, law school stopped being fun. You know, I got, as you've said, I got too attached to it. The outcome meant too much. My identity got wrapped up in whether or not I got the right job, that sort of thing. It took about a year. You know, law school is a three-year process. So for the first year, I had fun. The second year, I got too serious about myself and had a miserable time. And then I realized what was going on. And the third year, had a blast again. But my grades plummeted.
So kind of what I'm hearing is your strategy has always been to seek challenge and to seek adventure and something that's going to stretch you.
That sounds good. At least it was at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, I haven't talked about it in this way for quite a while. And I'm hearing in myself, a theme has always been letting go of self-importance. Mm. I think I find my greatest happiness and most success when I let go of my self-importance.
God, I wish I could learn that trick. Can you teach it me? It's just learning that one, Eric.
I will say that it's gotten a little bit more, a little easier recently. We talked in the video cast about how I lost my law firm, and after losing the firm, you know, all of the trappings that went along with the identity of being a lawyer also evaporated. And at first I was scared by that loss, and then I was angry and seeking somebody to blame. And then I was depressed, you know, how could I have put so much time into something just to get nothing, quote unquote. And then when all of that passed, I realized that the me that is the most important me had nothing to do with any of that. It had nothing to do with being a lawyer or any of the financial components of that success. The me that matters is so much greater than those outward manifestations can ever encompass. That peace is available in every moment, regardless of circumstances. And since that, it's been unwavering. You know, that realization has been unwavering since then.
So let's go just a little bit deeper, as you like to say when you talk on your podcast. Or I don't know whether that was the other lady I was listening to on your podcast went. But anyway, you with your, you know, you went from qualifying as a lawyer, and then you, I remember in your biography, you went into a law firm, and then pretty much you kind of went to the top. Or then did you then create your own law firm? How did it work?
Well, following along my my normal path, right after law school, I worked on a film project thinking I would never be a lawyer, as I said, and it didn't work out. And I wasn't sure what to do, but I knew that I always wanted to live in San Francisco. So I moved here with no money and no job and no apartment, and looked for an apartment on Craigslist, took about a month to find one. And when I found, and then just started just temping, doing anything I could to bring in a little bit of money to pay rent, and had the realization at that time that all I really wanted in life was to make a difference, whatever the heck that meant, and to have a decent living. And I realized, wow, you know, you did pass the bar exam and you are a lawyer, so you could practice law if you wanted, and you could probably make a difference doing that. Again, whatever the heck that means. So I just hung out a shingle. I had no idea how to market a law firm or how to run one, and I had definitely no idea how to be a lawyer. These are three important things they don't teach you in law school. So I just hung out a shingle, and cases started to come in, and I would pre-interview my clients before they came into the office and then frantically brush up on that area of the law so that I didn't sound like a complete moron when we were having our first interview. And then I would take their cases and kind of wing it. And I did a pretty good job for folks, started to get a reputation, and pretty soon I had a law firm.
Wow.
So I started from, again, it's just sort of a sense of adventure. And I think also a sense, I think a kind of entitled naivete, if I can be critical of myself. You know, nothing had ever really failed in my life. Everything had pretty much worked out. I had been exceptionally lucky. And I think that gave me a kind of naive sense of confidence to do anything. And so, you know, I just started a law firm. What the heck? Why not? And it worked.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you trained, but you trained and then you got your degree, you're saying, and then you had a gap where you then doubted yourself after you got your qualification. Why didn't you just go straight to a law firm and say, here's my qualification, can I just be a lawyer or something?
Well, you know, I mentioned that I'd gone to law school telling myself I'd never be a lawyer.
Yeah.
And then I got caught up in the prestige of it in the midst of law school but stopped having fun in life. And that third year of law school decided once again, nope, definitely I'm never going to be a lawyer. But I decided to take the bar, sort of to put the period on the sentence of law school, you know, to finish the process. So I took the bar exam, got a license, and then decided I wasn't going to use it.
Yeah.
So when I was in San Francisco considering what to do, it seems obvious in retrospect, of course, you would practice law. But at the time, I was trying to stand by my convictions of doing anything other than law, and really only decided to do it because at the time I was trying to access something that was more important than a career choice. And for me, that was this idea of making a difference, which I don't relate to in the way that I did at the time, but I wanted to have a positive impact on as many people as I could. And so even though I had been rejecting this abstraction called the career of being a lawyer, it was an obvious tool to make a difference with people. So yeah. I picked it up. But it wasn't, it didn't align with what I had planned to do. I think as with so many things in life, you know, the plans aren't that important in the end.
Yeah. No, great. So going from your strategy is having the challenge, having the adventure, having the fun along the way, but there's definitely a big thing in there for you about having that fulfillment. And as we know, the best way to get fulfillment is to look to fulfill others' needs. And you'd be doing that as a lawyer. And I read in some of your biography, you were saying, obviously, you know, here I am, a family lawyer, dealing with divorces, and actually starting to get to the point where I can see a real way of making a difference in actually maybe not having people choose divorce as the option, or maybe being happily divorced, you know, working through it as a happy option. So when did that realization come? when you were in your law firm?
Well, you know, divorce, so I sort of fell into divorce. Divorce was the work that was coming in the door, and it turned out I was good at it. So I kept doing it and eventually specialized in it. And, but at first it was very emotionally challenging for me. I felt depressed by breaking couples up. Although I knew logically I wasn't breaking them up, it still felt like it. And it did take some time for me to come to the realization that I wasn't responsible for their lives, but that I could make a difference in their lives with approaching the divorce in a particular way. And, you know, we at that firm did that. We did divorce in a good way. We did divorce as good, I think, as a lawyer can, with a real focus on the long-term impact on the family and the individuals, as opposed to our bottom line. That said, the thing about the divorce context in the midst of it is there's a lot of victimization and blame going around. Somebody is getting scapegoated for bad feelings almost all the time when a divorce goes to litigation. And sometimes that's the lawyers, sometimes it's the other parties, but it was never for me comfortable to be around that constant scapegoating. Despite the good work that we did, that was always present. And you know, I would have continued doing it because we were making good money if it hadn't been for the external factors, the shenanigans that my partner was up to that eventually destroyed the firm. And, you know, at the time I was so angry at him for having done it, but I look back now so grateful, because I would have continued as a lawyer. You know, that money is seductive. I would still be in that career, still wondering why I was involved in an ecosystem of victimization. I really did need to be thrust out of it to leave it. And, you know, it was... As a spiritual teacher that I like a whole lot, Adyashanti says, it was a bit of fierce grace. Mm. You know, I kind of lost everything and gained the universe as a result. And I couldn't be more grateful for that.
Exactly. And it's just perfect. And you know, there's a lot of coaches out there that say, walk towards the discomfort. And you know, that's where the golden nuggets are. So, okay. So I get that you're starting, and I totally agree with your whole victimization thing. I mean, I saw it in my own divorce, and it is thrust upon you by the lawyers that they're trying to find fault and blame. And actually my main mantra during the divorce was, I just wanted responsibility for the children's sake, that we be as amicable and as loving, et cetera, as possible. So, and it was the right choice for me. So, I'm totally agreeing with you there. So what, I had a really good question previously that I was going to ask you. Oh yeah. With the strategy piece, and we were saying, you know, you had the challenge and then you were trying to avoid being the lawyer, but you wanted the challenge. And during that time, when you were going through all of that, and then you said you were in a music club and you were running nightclubs, etc., and then you were like avoiding it, and then you go into the family, you know, you build up your law firm. Are you conscious at that point that I'm trying to avoid all the greed and the money, and I'm trying to make a difference? And are you conscious of all that, what we're discussing now? Or at the time, was it like you were just trying to follow your intuition? Do you see what I mean? Was there a plan, or were you just like, I'm not even aware of this?
You know, I look back on those days and ask myself that same question, because I had done, as we talked about in the video cast, I had done a lot of personal development work when I was younger. And as a result of that personal development work, I had a kind of, I guess you could call it an academic understanding of the egoic structure, you know, the self-protecting identity matrix that we all have that makes us feel safe because we know who we are and why we're important and that sort of thing. So I had this academic understanding of it, and I would observe myself putting on the trappings of being a lawyer and becoming addicted to the money and the prestige and the board positions that I was sitting on and my nice apartment. And I had this sense of sort of floating above it and wondering why I was taking it so seriously and knowing that it was the wrong path, but doing it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I also I was a smart enough rat in the maze to be able to use the language of self-awareness and to kind of convince myself that I wasn't doing this thing that obviously would provide no fulfillment, that obviously wasn't true, but I was doing it anyway. Mm. You know, a particularly poignant example is the way that I dated women. I was trying desperately to convince myself that I wasn't a player, I guess is the term for it. You know, but I was. I was out there trying to conquer relationships, you know, trying to conquer, to have conquest in order to prove that I was valuable as a man. And it wasn't until the loss of a law firm and an experience that I had in Tibet where I put someone's life at risk and had to really come face to face with my identity in a way that I never had before. That finally began to crumble, not just in an intellectual way, but rooted deep in my identity. Yeah. That was the most fascinating and valuable thing I think that's happened in my life was all of that loss. But I don't know if there's a way to create it, you know, because I knew intellectually what was going on, but it didn't matter because it wasn't in my bones. Mm-hmm. Now, post all of that, post all of the loss and the introspection and the realization that my identity is not, the identity that's operating in the world is not the most important thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is just where awareness is meeting responsibility. And
And what I'm struggling with in articulating to you right now is something that I've never tried to talk about this before, but it's the distinction between knowing the thing intellectually and actually getting it.
Yeah.
I really did know that my ego was running the show and that it wasn't so important, but I didn't get it. And now I get it. And I got to tell you, the universe is utterly different. The world is profoundly different than it's ever been. And from the moment of that realization, it's never gone back.
Yeah.
Things are just easier and more joyful now because I really don't care so much. I don't care so much about myself or my success or, you know, how I'm perceived. Because I'm attached to a greater truth, I guess.
Which is?
You know, it's going to sound sort of wishy-washy. It's going to sound a little spiritual woo-woo. So I apologize in advance.
You're a divorce lawyer. It's not going to sound woo-woo. Don't worry. Ex-divorce lawyer, yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. So I was having a sip of coffee one day, and I was considering the nature of my mind. I was thinking about my attachment to ego. And I was desperately trying to get rid of the mind. I was thinking, if it's the source of all the suffering, I want to get rid of identity. I want to crush it.
I've tried to do that before. Yeah.
I was trying so hard. It doesn't work. And I read a quote from a writer named Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he said, it was a, I don't remember exactly how the quote goes, but essentially it said, by the way, you know, your mind isn't going anywhere. It's always going to be there. The problem is you're over-identified with it. And I was sitting in a cafe. I just read that quote. I was having a sip of coffee and boom, everything changed. It was like a nuclear bomb went off. And I had several cascading realizations all at once. The first was that there that identity was something so much bigger than I had ever thought, which led to realizing that, oh, I finally get it. All things are one thing. Oh. Sorry, that's my phone. I thought I had it on silent.
But here comes the big line, because I was saying, and what is that? They're the greater thing. And then your phone goes off and it's spiritual awakening.
It's so perfect because it just reminds, it doesn't matter.
Okay, did we say before this podcast, please turn off all phones, fire exits are here, here, and here, and oh, goodness. Yeah.
It is on silent, which is odd. Well, okay, so it is literally on silent at this moment and yet ringing.
Anything to do with phones, it's an emergency. I have two teenagers, so anything connected with phones is an emergency.
Well, it's kind of funny because we were just talking about this, you know, like the world is perfect. And then in the midst of that conversation, we're interrupted by a problem that's obviously imperfect. And I think it illustrates what I'm trying to get at exceptionally well, because everything is perfect. That was the realization that I had in that moment that's never left me. And yet we are in this world where we bump up against one another and we bump up against our lack of resources, and it's painful. You know, we do experience pain and we call that imperfection. And yet there's this abiding truth that it is all perfectly encompassed in something utterly, fundamentally, completely whole and complete.
Yeah. And that in our accepting that comes, you know, kind of fulfillment, really, because like you say, I think all the imperfections actually lead us to a lot more happiness and joy. And there's just, we're living in a world where it's got to be perfect. People are airbrushed out, you know, like literally the girl I saw from Dirty Dancing, Jennifer, whatever. And she was on this dance show years later and she'd had her nose done and she was so beautiful in Dirty Dancing. And now I saw her and I didn't even recognize her. And I didn't even think she was attractive because she just looked like every other girl. So I know that's a weird comparison. But I just thought about that. But it's just this whole idea of what are we trying to do in going for this perfection thing, is we're ruling out happiness. And
yeah, and, you know, and in the moment when she was considering getting that nose job, somebody like me would have said, you're beautiful exactly as you are, you don't need to change anything, which is true. And then she got the nose job. And then that also is perfect. You know, the for whatever reason, and we can rationalize it. We can say it's perfect because then she learned a lesson, or now we have the opportunity to learn something, or the consequences worked out to be good. But it's not a matter of the good or the bad. You know, we can't ever dispute the fact that painful things are going to happen. They are, but the painful thing occurring is also part of this beautiful, extraordinary, unfolding perfection. And there's a way in which we all at any moment, without having some spiritual mind-blowing realization, we can all tap into that truth. And that is the shift that's occurred for me that is beyond the intellectual, is that now at any moment I stop and tap into that truth, that And there's lots of different ways to say it. All things are one thing. Everything is whole and complete. All things are perfect. Everything just is.
I think something like Eckhart's Tolle is just being present, being in the moment, and that the mind's not running the show, and it's just being here. And I've only just started to learn presence, because I was very much against this whole hippie, hippie movement of, hey man, just love each other and all the rest of it. That would just make me cringe. But I have found my own type of spiritual awareness, or at least the beginning of it, and just being able to sit there and in a moment just think, oh, I am just so enjoying. It's like yesterday, 8:30 in the morning, I was sitting on my sofa. I'd already taken the dog for a walk, which I love the crisp mornings, cold mornings, taking my dog for a walk after I've dropped the children off. And, you know, the sun is just rising. I love the countryside and the sheep. And then I get home and I'm sitting there on my sofa and I've just got a cappuccino in my hand and I'm listening to some stuff on my learnings. And I'm just thinking, I am just happy. The word I thought of, bliss. This is just, and I said it out loud, this is bliss. And I think, like you say, we learn this awareness, but then when we can kind of join that to taking responsibility for ourselves and our mind and just how we kind of go into our ego and all the rest of it. And in that moment, we can just learn to let all of that go and just be appreciative, which are kind of all these top coaches say, like Tony Robbins, you know, appreciate, have gratitude, you know, do all your healthy habits, and so that you can be present in the moment. So I think, you know, that for me is what you were just saying then. But
And to riff on that, I'll say that there, it's easy, you know, when we're on vacation and sitting on the beach in this ideal location and we're sipping on a delicious drink or whatever your idea is of the perfect moment, it's easy to tap into that all things are perfect in those moments. There's an insight that Eckhart Tolle has, however, that I've heard him articulate, which is that in any moment, if we stop and really consider, things are actually just fine. Mm-hmm. And that suffering, if not all the time, then most of the time, comes from this gap between being with what is actually happening and wanting something else to happen.
Yeah.
You know, it's that gap between what we think should be and what actually is.
Yeah.
Is where suffering resides. And really, when we stop and just experience what's actually happening, it's usually perfect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there was something I was reading a while back about in the whole idea of performance, that sometimes there is painful performance situations, but that doesn't mean that you can't actually be with that and be happy about that. That pain and, you know, suffering and, like you say, and growing and developing and stretching yourself, That can be painful, but it can still be fulfilling, because you know you're kind of growing. And this whole idea of, as humans, all we want to know is that we're progressing, that we've just progressed on a day. We've progressed towards some sort of thing that we're after. I mean, for some people, it might just be some money at the end of the week so you can go buy your beer, and get drunk or something. You know, everybody's progressing towards something, whether it be a small or a big goal or whatever. So, and for us, we deal in performance and relationships. For me, as I say, I can still see fulfillment even in the painful moments, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that makes perfect sense to me, and I'm glad you said it, because I think it's those painful moments where the rubber meets the road, and they can be fulfilling. That, in fact, they are fulfilling if we allow them to be, every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Get this whole idea of perfection out the way, really. When do you think, as a society, we're going to get that? Because at the moment, it's all over the media, perfect images of women, you know, airbrushed, you know, big movie stars, the guys, you know, the guy has to get the girl at the end of the film, and this whole idea of romance. And I think, I can't remember whether you said that in your podcast today, you know, the whole idea of, oh no, I don't, it was Mike Rowe who I was listening to, that, you know, this ridiculous idea that only to be happy, you have to find the perfect relationship, you know, like your soulmate. When do you think we're going to, because like there is a shift in consciousness that people are becoming more aware of themselves and the impact of their actions, and they're looking for companies to work with who have got a definite interest in bettering the world. And when do you think the shift will really start to happen, that imperfections and differences are perfect? You know, we're starting to see it with transgender and issues like that coming out, that, that there's lots of diversity now in the world. When is it really going to be acceptable? Because it's still not. Why are we still airbrushing stuff?
Well, of course, I can't predict the when, but I can say that the insight is available in every single second. It's available in every moment. And I've noticed another factor along with what you were just describing, which is we can see, I think, very distinctly in our political environment, at least here in this country. You know, we've recently elected somebody who has obfuscated the question of what's true. We all thought that we knew what was true, and now nobody's quite sure what is the truth. And we look for it on the surface, but I think there's a deeper approach to that question of what's true. And I think that question, the question of what's really true, is the question. That is the fundamental question that leads to awakening. And I'm quite excited to observe people beginning to have a need to ask that question culturally right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, and I think you're right, because I've started to see things on social media where people are advocating, really look to the source of where this is coming from, you know, because obviously you can read something and believe it. There is no just one news channel now. You can read news on social media, or you can read opinions on social media. So yeah, maybe people will start to self-check and start to validate information, and that will start the whole process of think there is imperfection, and it's just being aware of that. And but as to, like we were saying, as to when this whole perfect image of what it is to be a perfect person with a perfect relationship, as to when that will start to change, I don't know, because that's certainly going to start to affect divorce, surely, because people get divorced because they think they've got an imperfect relationship, when actually that is the way it should be.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's certainly one of the reasons that they get divorced or suffer pain in whatever is going on in life. Yeah, I really think that it starts by wondering what's true on a factual level, you know, in this universe, what's true in terms of facts. So then people start to inquire into what's true in terms of news, but then turn to the deeper question of what's really true. What is actually truth? What is truth? Ultimately, you know, that inquiry leads us to a place where we realize that our suffering and our striving and our struggling is not that important. Mm. You know, just skipping all the details in the middle, the ultimate realization is, you know, the things that we think matter really don't. They don't matter that much. And it doesn't mean we should stop pursuing them, but we don't need to take them quite so seriously. And, you know, that leads to a lot more contentment and, yes, probably a lot less divorce.
But, and also the things I'm learning is that there is no truth, because from one perspective, this is true. But from another perspective, it's the whole elephant thing. You know, the person standing at the front says, yeah, I can see two great big ears and a big trunk, this big long thing, and then the person at the back is going, no, there's like this little tiny little fluffy thing that's poking out and just two legs and a bum. What are you talking about? You know, like this is true. There is just a little tail and a bum. But no, there's this big long trunk. And so there is no truth. It's just perspective.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's I'm glad you brought that up. So this is the great paradox, because in the universe that you and I are talking to one another, in this world where you know, we are each these individual people and we have our agendas and we're talking to one another over the internet, in this world there are facts, and facts are you know, in this context of duality, the facts are true. And there's interpretation of those facts, which is where I think we're getting caught up culturally right now. But there are facts, and those facts are important for the smooth operation of this world. And I don't ever want to discount those. But at the same time, and this is where the paradox kicks in, at the same time, the only thing that's true, the only thing that can fundamentally be established as actually the case, indisputably, is that an experience is happening. There is an experience occurring, and that's all. We don't know if the details of it are true. We don't know if we're in a simulation. We don't know if the people that we're talking to are... Jeez, I'm so sorry with my phone. I promised that it is off right now.
Yeah.
But we don't know if the people that we're talking to are actually humans or if they're simulations. We have to operate as if they're real because that's what our experience is telling us, and it would be crazy not to. But fundamentally, we don't know. What we know is that an experience is happening. From that place is where this utter contentment and peace in each moment is generated. At the same time, however, in this world, if we apply that existential thinking to our day-to-day activities, we end up nihilists. And, you know, nihilism is a philosophical dead end. It leads to extraordinary injustice in this world. So we have to be able to hold both of these truths at the same time. And it's tricky, but it can be done. And it's a great way to skate through the world, I must say.
Nihilism, sorry, I'm really, obviously, is what I've heard of it before. What is nihilism?
It's the idea that nothing is true, that the only thing that exists is the self. And it can lead to, and if a fundamental mistake in that understanding is made, it can lead to, depression or very bad acts in the world. Yeah. And that fundamental mistake is, if nothing is true and nothing matters, then it's a bad thing that nothing matters.
Yeah.
I said that in kind of a confusing way. Yeah. But people start to think that if people start to think that it matters, that nothing matters.
Yeah.
It can feel very empty and lost. But the truth is that it doesn't matter that nothing matters. Mm-hmm. And if you can hold on to that, it's freeing. If you get stuck in the scariness of nothing mattering, of the fundamental emptiness, the fundamental aloneness of being, if you get stuck in the scariness of it, you get weighed down by it. But if you let go and release into it because of the fundamental truth of it, then it's utterly fulfilling.
Yeah, but my whole take on that one is that we then have the choice to choose what we attach value to. And that in itself comes fulfillment of being alive, you know, it's the choice. That's why we are humans and not a dog or a bird, which doesn't have the choice in necessarily in what they're doing in their actions.
Yeah, we do have an immense amount of choice when we become aware of this fact, and that choice can drive a lot of success in this world. That also can be a dead end, though. You know, if we start thinking that we have, within this world of physicality, if we start thinking that we have 100% choice and that we're not driven a little bit by culture, we can start beating ourselves up for not choosing the right thing all the time.
Yeah.
You know, we are impacted by our environment in this world. And that's why I say you need to be able to hold both truths at the same time. I hope I haven't been too confusing about this, but you know, you've got to be able to hold the kind of ultimate existential truth that, you know, that the only thing that's true is that there's an experience, and at the same time, live in this world of facts and reality and society and influence.
No, you haven't been confusing at all, and extremely deep philosophical person that I am learning from as we go. And Eric, just to kind of tie that section off and then move on to, because I'm conscious that I really want to have this done in an hour as a podcast, with the second section, we look at strengths. And as I say, I don't want to kind of roll over what you're saying and, you know, completely ignore what we've just finished. But to move on to strengths and weaknesses, and that the whole section around strengths and weaknesses, traditionally and this has gone on into a more philosophical, you know, deeper discussion on just one side, but traditionally what I do in leadership takeaways is someone's strengths and weaknesses, and this for you can be whatever you so wish. I would like to point it in the direction of you, where you're at now and in your choice of what you do on a daily basis.
Okay.
And obviously you can point it in whichever direction you so choose. What would you say is your strengths and weaknesses that get you by and that have you where you are now?
You know, I love doing these podcast interviews more than anything I've ever done. And I think that what makes the podcasts work for me is my curiosity for people, coupled with a lack of judgment. And I consider both of those strengths on the show. I'm fascinated by what people are going through. I love the human experience. I love exploring what people are up to and the underlying mechanisms for it. And at the same time, I don't condemn people for being where they are. I guess it could be called compassion. I have a lot of compassion for what people are up to. And also I really think it's okay to be going through what we're each going through. So I think that creates a safe space for people to open up on the show. And I think that's what makes the show successful. The kind of curiosity combined with a lack of critical judgment.
Yeah, I definitely got that from listening to the podcast we mentioned in the hangout that we filmed, that I could see a huge amount of compassion naturally, because we were discussing, does it come naturally to you? And instead it kind of being a bit conditioned by your mom, and she was really open to self-awareness and being aware of others and wanting to listen to others. So it's sort of become who you were. And I said the huge amount of patience that you had in your interview when you were speaking to two people who were having some challenges in a relationship. So those definitely are huge things that would arm you to be able to deal with those situations. Have you got any weaknesses?
Well, I can get a little self-important.
Sorry, I'm agreeing with you. Like, I can see that with myself. Yeah.
Yeah, I can get a little self-important. And then I am very grumpy when I'm hungry and when I wake up. And I have to say that that's the greatest challenge in my relationship with my partner. We, when we have spats, it's always in the morning or when I'm hungry.
Yeah.
I really, I don't always like myself in those moments.
Yeah. Yeah. Just keep huge amounts of food and coffee around you. Yes. Feed him coffee or else the monster's going to erupt. Yeah. And the other part we look at is resources, Eric. And what would you say, what type of resources have armed you throughout? I mean, we've talked about personal development, which obviously has really armed you for the kind of the way you've worked through life. And it's, you know, enabled you to sort of cope and deal well and get the best out of life. What other resources do you use daily, weekly, you know, monthly? What have you traditionally used? What works for you?
You know, that makes me think about, I'm really lucky to have been born a tall white male. You know, people have an unconscious positive response to me because of those things. And I don't want to place everything on it, but I don't want to discount it either. I mean, it really is, it's really a leg up in this world.
Oh, that's sad though. Surely if you're saying if you were a different, you know, skin color, that you saying that would, you know, people would not, they'd discount you more as a, what, podcaster, ex-family lawyer, in the world today, you still, because I don't know, is it still breaking through those ceilings? And I think probably similar for women. I think there's still, women have to work harder.
Yeah, I think they do. You know, we're getting into a political discussion that I don't mind going into. I don't know if it's useful for your show, but just to address it briefly, yeah, in this world, that we're, again, in this world of fact where you and I are talking to one another, we are very much still all impacted by these cultural signals.
Right.
And, you know, in the world, on this planet today, white English-speaking men still have most of the power and most of the wealth. Mm-hmm. And people give us more opportunity unconsciously without meaning to than they do to other types of people. And I think that's something we should work to equalize, in this world. And I also acknowledge that it's just what's true. Yeah. You know, what's true is what's true. Yeah. It's just what's so.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of work to do and we should do that work. And, you know, this is just how the world is. And so here again with the paradox, you know, on one hand, let's acknowledge what's true and allow it to be what's true. On the other hand, let's take action and change what we don't like. Mm-hmm. You know, and I also want to say that I think that my moments of struggle, for me personally, my moments of struggle and loss have been the most fruitful.
Yeah.
So there's also benefit to struggle.
Yeah. And the impact of environment, like you're saying, sort of that one person be judged completely differently. But yet what that difficulty for them could create, or they could create around that difficulty, could be something great that could come from that. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's just difficult for me to hear it from you to say that you do think you're treated differently. I have generally been attracted to guys who are taller, and then it makes you think, well, what about the short guy? Immediately I'm discounting a short guy. And you're right, those differences are there, and it can be painful to hear it. It's all right when it works in your favor, you know, I've got blonde hair and, you know, I look all right and I'd like to wear dresses and, you know, and I know I might sort of get attention. So it's okay when it works in your favor, but when you see the downside or you talk, you know, you discuss it, yeah, that's uncomfortable. But like you say, I think it's there and not enough people maybe actually acknowledge it. Just say, oh, you know, we're all right now. Everything's equal. Well, it's not equal. Women aren't paid the same. Things like that. So, and then the people who kind of talk about it are then vilified and made out to be, oh God, she's a raving loony feminist or something like that, just because they're talking about it.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting.
Which is just fear talking.
Yeah.
You know, anytime we have to obfuscate something that's true in this world, we're doing it out of fear.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great strength to be able to acknowledge what's true.
Yeah.
And a great privilege.
Yeah. And I think I heard a saying a while back, something to do with, when your love touches, when your love touches fear or someone's fear, it comes out as compassion. When your fear touches their struggle, it comes out as feeling sorry for them. I mean, I know I haven't worded that quite well, but when we're fearful, when we see somebody else's struggle, we're kind of fearful ourselves, and it comes out as our feeling sorry for them and trying to, you know, oh gosh, you know, help them out. But when you see someone else's struggle and you're just compassionate and you're just with it and you accept it, that's love. So so it's kind of like the love meeting the fear. It just comes out as compassion, but mm-hmm. Your own fear meeting someone else's fear comes out as a struggle.
Yeah, which might express as sadness, or it might express as a fight.
You know,
when fear touches fear, it turns into anger oftentimes. Yeah. Yeah. But when love, or another word to say that I think might be acceptance, when allowing touches a struggle, it comes out as compassion or peace.
Yeah.
I think it could be a lot more functional that way.
Exactly. So yeah, that's all it comes down to, Eric, is just fear. If there's either fear or love is walking into a room at any time.
Amen to that.
And that's it. And it's just us recognizing it and being highly aware of it or not ready to face that.
By the way, fear, because it's so fundamental. I know we're wrapping, but I just want to bookmark that fear is also inescapable. It's not as if fear can ever go away.
No.
Fear will always be present. It's just, fear is really nothing more than the experience of bumping up against a limitation, which is fundamental to this context we live in of duality. It's just the sensation of a limit bumping into another limit. And we call it fear. Sometimes it's stronger, but it's always present, and it's what gives us what we are. It's the fundamental essence of this dual context. It's the root of who and what and everything that we are. And it's okay.
Agreed. Because Elizabeth Gilbert. Sorry, carry on.
I was just agreeing with you that the thing to do is to embrace it.
Yeah. And Elizabeth Gilbert, again, you know, a novelist we discussed in our video interview, she was saying, like you were saying, fear is always going to be there, but I don't want fear driving the car. Fear can go in the back of the car. And I'm kind of loving your fear, because obviously fear has got us out of tricky situations where we needed to be fearful. We needed to run away, or, you know, your hand was being burnt by the kettle, so you pulled it away, or, you know, whatever it might be. Fear does protect us, but she's talking about just being with it. And but not letting it run the show, but also being aware of it, which you and I both are, you know, again, when you mentioned about being a tall white guy, and I could see my fear came up, my shame, my guilt, my disgust, you know, all of that came up, but you can just be with it because you know that those emotions are there, but like, you know, someone maybe not so aware wouldn't be able to put a voice to it quite like we do, or quite so eloquently like you do.
Thank you. Yeah. And I guess I would, and then just taking what Elizabeth Gilbert has said and maybe adding a small bit to it, I would say that the fear, it for me, it's not so much that I can ever put it in the boot of the car, but the pain associated with the fear can be let go, because the fear is always there. If we define, maybe it's just a matter of semantics, but we have to, if we define fear as the sensation of bumping against a limit, that is always there by definition of being a creature in this world. But the pain that we associate with that can be let go.
Yeah.
By just allowing this thing called fear to be, just allowing it to be exactly as it is, the pain starts to diminish.
Yeah. Yeah. And let go by sort of rewording it, you know, rewording it rather than as something, a loss or whatever. It's a challenge, or, you know, it's something fruitful, or just, but I think we're both kind of saying the same thing. I mean, wow, Eric, like we're on, an hour now, and yes, you're right. I am going to wrap it, as you Americans like to say. but we've kind of covered, what's fascinating is that we've kind of covered the format, which is, usually the strategy, the strengths, the resources, and then the, your insights and learning and how you move forward, where you're moving to. And we kind of covered a lot of the insights and learning at the beginning. But what was amazing, I always love about these interviews, is I've got four categories that I give. They're the same categories I give to each person, but each interview is worlds apart. And that for me is why I do this, because you know, what is success for one person is success for a different person, and then what is this for this person is just so, this is such another universe, kind of conversation that I've had here with you, and I've loved every minute of it, because I've learned stuff from you. How was it for you, and is there anything you'd like to kind of say as a final word before we wrap?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Really, it's been such. It really has been such a pleasure. It's great, great fun talking to you, and I'm honored that you would ask me to be on your show. So thank you.
And you're very, very welcome. And I really say I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I have enjoyed this, and hopefully some other people who will listen online will get something from it for themselves. So, Eric, it's been great, and take care and speak soon.
Definitely. Can't wait.